Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Eric H. Klein, director of the Capital Archaeological Institute at George Washington University, and the author of Three Stones Make a Wall, The Story of Archaeology, and 1177 BC, The Year Civilization Collapsed. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mavenah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shin Chinim, Barel Kachar and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This is the last full week of preparation before the holiday of Pesach, Passover, which begins a week from tomorrow night, Monday, April 10th. And there is nothing that says Pesach more than cleaning, cooking, and preparing. While some might think a non-Jewish holiday like, Christmas takes more preparation than any other festival, after all, people actually cut down trees and drag them into their living rooms. In truth, most of the holiday preparations for that December 25th American Bacchanal are actually not integral to the festival. Trees, electric lights, statues of reindeer, and expensive presents are not religiously mandated and didn't even begin to be part of that celebration until, 20th century. But Passover? Passover preparations are actually commanded in a series of tremendously ancient texts, beginning with the description of the very first Pesach some 3,250 years ago, on the night before we got out of slavery in Egypt. In the Torah in Exodus, and later in other regulations specified in Numbers and even Deuteronomy, we're told that on the Leil Shimurim, the watch night of the 14th of Nisan, we are to spend the evening and perhaps the whole night telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt and of our flight to freedom. We are to eat the roast Paschal lamb, the leaping sheep of freedom, with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, to teach our children the lesson of slavery and God's redemption to freedom. And we are commanded, not advised, but ordered, to eat only unleavened foods for the week that follows, to remove all chametz from our homes. If we live in Israel, we are supposed to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover there. The mitzvot, the commandments, are explicit and very ancient. But of course, that doesn't end the discussion or the requirements in Judaism. The rabbis of the Mishnah, which was completed nearly 1,800 years ago, and their successors who created the Gemara, finished about 1,550 years ago, added a whole array of ways to observe Passover that extended its sway into every area of our homes and our lives. The rabbis begin by asking what it means to remove leavening, chametz, from our homes. They created an entire system. It requires the most thorough spring cleaning imaginable, moving furniture and bookcases, unearthing closets, taking out every possible form of wheat or other grain-based products from our homes, and removing or cleaning every plate, platter, utensil, or appliance that's come into contact with leavening. That process of bedikat chametz, searching for chametz, mechirat chametz, selling chametz, and finally biur chametz, burning the chametz, which culminates in about a week, is a complicated observance. Once you've removed all of the leaven from your house, you technically don't need to throw it out or give it away. You can store it safely in a garage or even a sealed cabinet and formally sell it to a non-Jew for a nominal sum for the week of Pesach. This process is actually used in Israel for huge corporations like Osem that produced baked goods for the whole nation. Anyway, after technically selling off the chametz, mechirat chametz, I've always wondered what would happen if the Arab who owns all the chametz in Israel decided after Passover not to sell it back. Anyway, after selling it and searching for leftover leaven, bedikat chametz, whatever is left is burned. This process of biur is actually pretty fun. You gather up the last boxes of cereal, the leftover rolls or Pop-Tarts, and using a can or an enclosure or a chimney or whatever combustion chamber you have handy, you burn it up. I recall when I lived in Jerusalem, walking home the day of the first Seder, seeing small fires on every corner, some not so small ones, with people burning chametz in final preparation for Passover. It was a great cathartic moment, casting off your last bits of impurity before observing the great rituals of the Festival of Freedom. Of course, if the preparations for Passover simply included getting rid of chametz, this holiday would be easy. But it turns out there are many, many other things you need to do to get ready for the Passover Seder, the most rigorously structured meal you can imagine. This means having matzah, unleavened bread, wine, or grape juice enough for 4 cups for everybody to drink, bitter herbs in 2 forms, hard-boiled eggs, parsley, other spring veggies, charoset, the chopped fruit and nut mixture that's made to look like mortar. And all of that is before you eat your meal, which in Ashkenazic tradition includes gefilte fish, hot chicken soup with matzo balls, brisket, or other heavy main dishes. Interestingly, few Jews really eat lamb on Passover, and various other kosher for Passover dishes, kugels, and if you have any room left, non-rising desserts. The work involved in the Pesach Seder actually turns free Jews into slaves once again, at least in the preparation period, and the post-Seder cleanup is no less onerous than the prep. And then, if you are Orthodox or conservative or hosting a congregational Seder, as I am, you do it all over again for the second night. All that labor actually makes you appreciate freedom more fully, especially when it's over. And so, to play us in on this penultimate Sunday before Pesach, 8 days away, here's a setting of Vehi She'amda Lavotenu from the Haggadah for Passover. This, God and God's redemption, is what preserved our fathers and keeps us, for not only one rose to destroy us, but in every generation they try, and God saves us from their hands.
Vehi She'amda Lavotenu והיא שעמדה לאבותינו ולנו שלא אחד בלבד עמד עלינו לחלותינו עמד עלינו לחלותינו והיא שעמדה לאבותינו והיא שעמדה לאבותינו ולנו שלא אחד בלבד עמד עלינו לחלותינו עמד עלינו לחלותינו והקדוש ברוך הוא מצילנו מצילנו והקדוש ברוך הוא מצילנו מצילנו מידם והיא שעמדה
That was Vehi She'amda from the Passover Seder, sung by Yossi Azulai. Pesach's coming up, a week from tomorrow night. Our guest this morning, the distinguished Professor Eric Klein, is the director of the Capital Archaeological Institute at George Washington University, author of Three Stones Make a Wall, The Story of Archaeology, his new book, and 1177 BC, The Year Civilization Collapsed. Find out what is so captivating about archaeology, what it teaches us about the Bible and its people when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Hi, my name is Lauriella, and I'd like to tell you how you can help send children like me to a Jewish day school at no cost to you. Arizona allows its taxpayers to receive a tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations such as JETCO. JETCO is the only tuition organization solely dedicated to Jewish education in Tucson. JETCO provides scholarships to children who attend qualified private schools like Congregation Anshai Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, which educates students from grades K through 8th. You may give up to $1,087 for single tax filers and $2,173 for married couples who file jointly. Jewish education nurtures Jewish identity for generations of students like me, so please go online and visit our website at www.jetco.org or give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. And tell them Lauriella sent you.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish our guests this morning. Professor Eric Klein is an author, historian, archaeologist, professor of ancient history and archaeology at George Washington University, professor of classics and anthropology, and former chair of the Department of Classical and Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations. I probably missed six or seven other important titles. He's the author of a new book, Three Stones Make a Wall, as well as a number of other books on archaeology, has worked in Israel and throughout the Middle East for many years. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
I want to ask about your new book. Is it a more popular approach to explaining archaeology to people and the fascination with it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's meant to be a book that is accessible for anybody from age 7 to 70 or younger and older. And it's kind of a greatest hits of archaeology. It's all the famous sites, you know, Machu Picchu, Terracotta Warriors, Masada. But there's also chapters on how we actually do archaeology. How do you know where a site is? How do you know how to dig? How do you know how old something is? So all the questions that I'm usually asked at cocktail parties and dinners and things like that.
There are places where archaeology, like Israel, where everybody is an amateur archaeologist. And then there are places like the United States where people can't even begin to think about it. How do you reconcile those two kinds of locations?
It can be tough. More people do archaeology in the United States than you might suspect. A lot of people are, you know, kind of weekend hunters and such. And there's always a place you can go, call your local university or whatever, but there's tons of places that actually have archaeology where you can volunteer on a weekend. So it is not like a place like Israel where everywhere you go, there's stuff in the ground. But we've got a lot of stuff here, too. So it's actually not that hard to reconcile the two.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. The story in your new book, I read the chapter on Masada, and I've been to a lot of those places. Some of our preconceptions about these great archaeological sites aren't totally correct, are they?
Yeah, that's right. What I find interesting is that there's knowledge that's within the archaeological community and knowledge that's not, where Masada fits into that. For example, in the Masada chapter, I talk a lot about Yudin excavating and trying to test whether the story of the suicide that Josephus tells is correct or is archaeological provable. And these are things that we've been discussing for 20, 30 years now. And so, to me, they're kind of common knowledge. I've been lecturing on them for decades. And yet, when the chapter was excerpted recently, and people were like, wait, what? There's a debate? I'm like, yeah, of course there's a debate. And then I realized that outside of the small archaeological community, most people don't realize this. So I'm hoping that that's one of the things that the book will do. Is bring to a larger audience some of the things that we've been discussing within the archaeological community for quite a long time and make it known to a wider audience, because I think it's fascinating, and I'm hoping that other people will find it fascinating as well.
We will come back shortly with Professor Eric Klein and continue to explore archaeology and, I think the archaeology of Israel and lots of other interesting topics when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We are now pleased and serene to bring you an occasional feature of Too Jewish, two haikus for Jews from our Zen Judaism department. We opened the door for Elijah the prophet. Now our cat is gone. And lacking fins or tail, the gefilte fish swims with great difficulty. That was the Zen Judaism segment, Haikus for Jews, for the coming festival of Passover. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, a couple of years ago, I spent Seder in Cuzco, Peru, with a thousand Israeli backpackers on the Israeli backpack trips through South America. But the fact that there's a Jewish community, you know, way up at whatever it is, 10, 12,000 feet in the air in Peru is surprising to people. But there are Jewish communities kind of spread around Latin America, including some major ones like in Buenos Aires and your favorite place down there, Mendoza.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and the question just with what you started with, Cusco, is that a Jewish community or is it a Chabad outpost to minister to all the probably tens of thousands of Israelis who trek through there every year when they finish their military service and do the big South American route where at every stop, there are Hebrew-speaking guides and notes left by previous Israelis because it's such a well-traveled route that Chabad feels they have to minister to the spiritual needs of these people, especially at the high holiday time or Pesach time or whatever. I mean, I'm not convinced that there is actually a Jewish community in Cusco. On the other hand, as you say, there are large and important Jewish communities in places like Sao Paulo, Rio, Buenos Aires, all the big cities. In fact, Bogota. I don't know what's left of the Jewish community in Caracas, but it was once important. Mexico City, we've already talked about on this show. I think one thing all these communities have in common is that people have left due to either economic or political difficulties. Many people have made Aliyah or they've moved to Miami or both. They may have like part of the year a house in Jerusalem and part of the year a house in Miami. But one thing all these communities have in common is they're perceived by their non-Jewish neighbors as being larger, more powerful, more influential, and more wealthy than they in fact are. I think I mentioned to you the statistic that in Mexico City, there are, I don't know, 20 or 30,000 Jews. And, you know, it's a significant community with a lot of money. But smart, successful business people in Mexico City told me that there were at least 250,000. I mean, they multiplied the actual number of Jews by a factor of 10. And that, I think, happens all over Latin America. And it's not like, oh, well, 10 years ago, there really were that many Jews in Mexico City or Buenos Aires or whatever. The communities were never as big as non-Jewish neighbors perceive them to be.
You know, it's fascinating. I think that's not only true in Latin America, but elsewhere. You were talking about the wine region, Mendoza, where you go frequently, and the fact that there's maybe 200 Jewish families in the whole town, a whole city, but the perception, because, you know, the car dealer is Jewish and they take one kind of a big trip to Israel every year, is that there's all kinds of Jewish influence there.
Right. And, you know, probably they bring in a rabbi at some point to supervise the production of kosher wines at one or more of the wineries. And this happens even in countries that have tiny Jewish communities, but large wine industries like Bulgaria. There's one winery that works with a mashgiach who sets up like literally a tent, and he and his crew live there for part of the year. I don't think they're there full time. So I don't know how hashgacha works really if you're only supervising the production part of the time. You might be able to explain that to your listeners.
Right, I'll work on
perhaps
that.
Next week we can get into that.
Maybe when we get closer to Pesach. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Bariel, head of the Wine Tribe Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We are entering the month of Nisan. Well, we're in it now, the month of Pesach, such an important month. We tend to think about Passover because of all the preparation and the cooking, or, oh yeah, we got to eat matzah. But that's not really the purpose of Passover. And you mentioned a poem that happens to be one of my favorites from Amnon Rybak.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful poem, and saying that everyone needs to have his own personal Egypt, Yetziat Mitzrayim, its own exodus of Yetziat Mitzrayim, its own avdut. How do you translate avdut?
Your own servitude,
slavery?
Your own slavery. Yeah,
each of us committed to, you know, some, I don't know, to complain on stuff, to be, you know,
you
to limit to yourself, to create your own, you know, glass ceiling. You know, we are limiting ourselves, and we are as a son of God, we are created to shine and to let others shine next to us, right?
Right.
And so that's beautiful. Whenever I'm down, I'm not waiting to Pesach. I'm just, you know, reading his poem, and really inspiring poem.
Which is a larger theme, really, for this whole season. In order to understand freedom, you have to understand the slavery that you yourself are in.
Nahon.
And while, of course, there's real slavery in the world still, and there are people in worse conditions and imprisoned and so on, the truth is we each have to come from our own limitations and find our way to freedom. Is there something special as we approach this Pesach that you think about for yourself, or even for the Israel Center, a way, a kind of a prison that you're in or thinking you might be in that you need to break out of in the spirit of Amnon Rybak?
You know what? That's a great opportunity, because I'm here, you know, that's my fourth year. And when I came here, I kind of limited myself in terms of saying what is my political approach. And it's not that I wasn't allowed to, but I really wanted the freedom to change my mind, to come here open. You know, if I would say I'm in favor of this or this, and then I will be committed. So, and it's also related to other aspect of things that I limit myself, which is Lashon Hara. And sometimes I'm saying like, I won't say anything about someone because I would like to change my mind. Today he was bad to me. I hate him today. But if I say that, next day he will be amazing to me. And I won't be able to say how amazing he is only because I already said something. So I would like to have, I wish myself more insights along this amazing journey that I took my family and myself into it. And just to be open hearted to, you know, everything around me. Sometimes we're keeping ourselves so busy and not being able to see all the amazing things around us and the small things that we can do, not the huge one. We won't change the world in one day, but I would like to do more in the community that's not related to Israel. I would like to do more with the Muslim community. I would like to lead the course with you. And I told you. So, yeah.
Me too. Ashrat, thanks very much. You know, we think about Pesach as a time for freedom, but maybe it's also a time to see the miracles around us that aren't only the crossing of the Red Sea. We'll talk next week.
Chag Sameach.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates serving Tucsonians living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Tov. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, it's certainly tax season now.
Yes.
And a reminder of an important and interesting Arizona phenomenon, the tax credit.
Each of us has a tax liability if we work that, we have to pay state taxes. This is how the system works. And it's pretty amazing that an individual can say, I would like my tax dollars to go to this specific cause. So right now, an individual can contribute slightly over $1,000 to JETCO, and a married couple can contribute double that, slightly over $2,000 to JETCO. And those funds go directly towards Jewish learning here in Tucson.
It's a terrific way to make sure that the tax dollars go directly to Jewish day school education. Just idly, how does that money get distributed?
Sure. So the money is distributed to families who present a financial need, and it's a confidential process that is managed sort of outside of the JETCO operation, and then recommendations are made to the JETCO board, who reviews some of the financial information and makes decisions about where those funds go. It's an anonymous type of an arrangement because the JETCO board does not know which family is requesting assistance, nor do they know to where the dollars go. So there's a lot of privacy involved in the process. But the family presents a financial need through filling out some documents and also presenting some tax information to the organization. And decisions are made by the JETCO board.
So it allows families otherwise wouldn't be able to afford a Jewish day school education to be able to
absolutely
have the
right. And you know,
access to that quality.
Yes, it's a key component of the organization at THA. Many, many of our families, over 75% of our families, receive some type of tuition assistance. So, you know, back in the day where THA might have been a private school that was affordable for a certain component of society, things have changed. And now it's wide open. Anybody can afford a Jewish day school education here in Tucson.
Thanks, John. Don't forget to give to JETCO. We'll talk next week.
Thanks, Rabbi.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. With Passover just a week away, the Jewish community in Madrid found itself in a desperate situation. There was an acute shortage of horseradish, key ingredient of that fiery condiment for gefilte fish known as chrein. A cry arose and the whole community was mobilized to prevent this shanda, this shameful tragedy. All the European Union countries gave the same reply. Sorry, we have no chrein to send. In desperation, the rabbi of Madrid phoned one of his friends in Tel Aviv and begged him to send a crate of horseradish by air freight to Madrid. Just 2 days before Passover, a crate of grade A, tear-jerking Israeli horseradish was loaded at Ben-Gurion Airport onto an El Al flight to Madrid, and all seemed to be well. But when the rabbi went to the Madrid airport to claim the horseradish, he was told that a wildcat Spanish strike had just broken out. No shipments could be unloaded for a week. He got just a few ounces, but not nearly enough for all the Spanish Jews. Yes, as a result, the chrein in Spain stayed mainly on the plane. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's Parsha is the second in the book of Leviticus, Tzav, a section that establishes rules for the various sacrifices offered in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Mishkan. These same sacrifices were later also offered in the temple in Jerusalem for about 1,000 years. There are many different types of sacrifices commanded in Tzav, burnt offerings, guilt offerings, sin offerings, and so on. But one group of sacrificial offerings stands out, the offerings of peace, the Zevach Shlamim. Among this higher category of offerings, one in particular is even higher, the Zevach Todah, the Thanksgiving offering. The rabbis thought so highly of Thanksgiving to God that they are quoted in the Talmud saying that when the Messiah comes, all sacrifices will have completed their mission, all will be discontinued with one exception, the Thanksgiving offering. That sacrifice will last forever, even after the Messiah comes. But why? Well, because even in a perfect world, we should remember to give thanks, to be grateful for what we have. This Shabbat is also Shabbat HaGadol, the great Sabbath preceding Passover. The name is taken from its famous Haftarah, which proclaims the coming of the great and awesome day of God, in which the prophet Elijah will come and turn the hearts of children to their parents and the hearts of parents to their children. All of us experience challenge in our lives. But we do well to remember the many things we have to feel grateful for. On the Shabbat of Tzav HaGadol, may we come to value those eternal blessings, family, friends, and the freedom to practice our faith in this special season of the year. Our Jewish Poetry Slam this morning is from Marge Piercy, part of her Passover poetry cycle. It's called Charoset. Sweet and sticky, I always make too much at Pesach, so I have an excuse to eat you all week. Moist and red, the female treat, nothing at all like clay for bricks, nothing like mortar. No, you are as sweet as a mouth kissing, fragrant with cinnamon, spicy as Havdalah boxes. Don't go on too long, you whisper sweetly, heed the children growing restive, their bellies growling. You speak of pleasure in the midst of remembered pain. You offer the first taste of the meal, promising joy like a picnic on a stone. Where long ago an ancestor was buried, too long ago to weep, we nod. Remembering is enough to offer, like honey. If much of what we must recall is bitter, you are the reminder that joy, too, lights its candles tonight in the mind. That was the Passover poem Charoset from Marge Piercy. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, archaeologist Eric Klein, will explain how you can get involved in digging up crucial clues to humanity's past and what it can teach us about the Bible. Find out when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country, too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates, serving Tucsonans living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley told the AIPAC conference in Washington, D.C. last week that the Trump administration will not allow a repeat of last year's United Nations Security Council resolution condemning Israel for its settlements. We will never again do what we saw with Resolution 2334 and make anyone question our support for Israel, Nikki Haley said at the annual AIPAC conference, where she earned the warmest reception of any speaker and got an extended standing ovation. The Obama administration allowed anti-settlement resolutions last December to be voted on as one of its last acts, triggering bitter recriminations from Israel's government, Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and others, and from many here in America. Nikki Haley described her determination to help steer the course of the UN and its agencies away from anti-Israel bias, noting her intervention in keeping Salam Fayyad, the former Palestinian prime minister, from becoming the body's envoy to Libya, in getting UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to withdraw a UN affiliate's report likening Israel to an apartheid state. She also vowed to fight BDS and to defend Israel against it. Nicaragua and Israel have reestablished full diplomatic relations, effective immediately after they were suspended in 2010 by Daniel Ortega. The two governments place great importance on the renewal of relations with the aim of promoting joint activity for the welfare of both peoples and to contribute to the fight for peace in the world, Nicaragua's foreign ministry said. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega suspended diplomatic ties with Israel in 2010 in protest after Israeli commandos staged a deadly raid on a flotilla trying to break the blockade of Gaza, the Mavi Marmara raid that also damaged Israel's relationship with Turkey for 6 years. That relationship has now been repaired, and apparently the one with Nicaragua as well. In 2012, Ortega, the leftist Cold War antagonist of the U.S., when he was head of the Sandinistas, urged Israel to destroy its nuclear weapons as he hosted then-Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in Managua. He remains in power in Nicaragua, but it has now restored relations with Israel nonetheless. In other less sanguine news, Bernard Marks, an 87-year-old Auschwitz survivor, chastised Sacramento County Sheriff Scott Jones for not serving his community. He did that at a community forum in which County Sheriff Jones stood alongside Acting ICE Director Thomas Homan in Sacramento, California last week. "We did not elect you as Sheriff of Washington, D.C., said the Holocaust survivor during his turn at the microphone. "It's about time you serve the people here." Marks likened the recent ICE raids, he says, are tearing families apart to his own family's incarceration in concentration camps, urging Jones not to forget that history is not on your side. In an op-ed published by the Sacramento Bee March 3rd, Marks compared the rising nationalism and shift in law enforcement in the U.S. to the social climate in his hometown of Lodz, Poland, in the early stages of Nazi occupation. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World.
Our brothers,
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Eric Klein, has a new book, Three Stones Make a Wall, a wonderful exploration of archaeology and sort of the greatest hits of archaeology. He has written a number of books, dug extensively at Megiddo and elsewhere in Israel and around the world. Professor of Classics and Anthropology, Director of the George Washington University Capital Archaeological Institute, and one of the more prominent archaeologists in the world. So I want to talk about your last book. It's about the arrival of the Sea Peoples and the end of civilization, which those are always interesting topics, ends of civilization. Tell us about that, because it has such an enormous impact on the whole of the Mediterranean, particularly the parts that we're most interested in Israel.
Yeah, so that book, 1177 BC, The Year Civilization Collapsed, it came out in 2014 and then in paperback in 2015. And somewhat to my surprise, it's selling well. It's actually selling better than all my other books combined. And I've written books on Megiddo and Jerusalem and biblical archaeology, but I think that this one hit a note in part because one of the things I did was compare what happened in 1177 to what's happening in the world today. And there are a lot more parallels than one might expect. In fact, there's enough parallels that makes you a little bit nervous. So I think it kind of came out at exactly the right time, if you want to put it that way. But 1177 is the year where the entire civilized world in the Mediterranean, from Italy over to Afghanistan, just completely collapsed within a couple of decades. And this was the period, late Bronze Age, when King Tut was around and Hatshepsut. So the time of Ramses II, time of the Exodus, time of the Trojan War. It's a period that a lot of people know a little bit about, but not much in terms of what happened. So it was a globalized world for its time. It was an international world. And it was happily going along for 200-400 years. And then all of a sudden everything came crashing down. So the Mycenaeans and Minoans in Greece left the stage. Hittites in Turkey, Cypriots, Canaanites move away. Egypt, Assyria, Babylonia. Everything kind of comes to a crashing halt. The question is why. The Egyptians had said that this group called the Sea Peoples, that they left pictures of and inscriptions of, that they had caused it. In actuality, it's a little bit more complicated, and there are quite a few factors that stress out the world back then, including climate change, drought, famine, earthquakes, plus the invaders like the Sea Peoples. And it's kind of a perfect storm. So what I did in that book was I went through the evidence for the Sea Peoples, but also the evidence for the other things that it may have contributed to the collapse. But since I wanted to talk about what collapsed as well as why or how it collapsed, the middle part of the book is actually about Mycenaeans, Minoans, Hittites, Canaanites, those people. It's basically in the centuries before the Israelites show up. But one of the things that I conclude at the end is that when things do collapse, it creates a power vacuum in that region, including in Canaan. And I think that's what actually sets the stage for the Israelites to be able to settle down, whereas I think a little bit earlier they would have had trouble with the Canaanites. So still the question as to when the Exodus actually took place, but it's somewhere in that time period, and the kind of the silver lining because of the collapse of the Bronze Age is that we're going to wind up with things like Israel and Judah being able to establish themselves.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating because I've always thought there had to be some sort of a power vacuum for this basically poor former slave people to suddenly emerge as an important power, or at least a people in its own land. It's a fascinating book.
I completely agree with you. I think it's because the Canaanites went down because of the Sea Peoples and the collapse. Otherwise, you're right. I think it doesn't really make sense that these little poor impoverished slave army could take on the huge power, but it works. It works.
Yeah, which had more material wealth. And then we keep hearing about the Sea Peoples, only we called them the Philistines for a long time.
The Philistines are one. There's actually nine groups that make up the Sea Peoples. And the Shardana probably come from Sardinia, the Shekeles from Sicily. Sicily, but one of the groups is the Peleset, and that they've always been identified with the Philistines. In fact, Champollion, the guy who deciphered hieroglyphics way back when, he had already said that the Peleset were probably the Philistines. And the Bible does say in a couple places that the Philistines are supposed to come from Crete, so that actually, it works quite nicely.
It does. Armageddon, you've had the pleasure of digging in the place that people think the end of the world has come or will come. Talk about Megiddo a little bit, if you would.
Sure. So I was part of the team excavating at Megiddo from 1994 on. We excavated every other year, so 94, 96, 98, and so on. And I started out actually as a volunteer in 94. Even though I had already had 15 seasons of experience elsewhere. But I wanted to be at a major site that people had heard of. I was tired of people asking me where I was working. And I wanted to dig in a place that kind of mattered to a lot of people. So I eventually worked my way up, and by the end I was co-director with Israel Finkelstein, which was just a joy to be working with him. And then after the 2014 season, I just had too much on my plate, and so I retired from that dig, because I have another dig at Kabri, which is way up north by Rosh HaNikra, which is a fascinating Canaanite palace with the oldest and largest wine cellar that dates almost 4,000 years ago. So I was doing that on.
I have to ask you, were there any intact bottles?
They were intact. They were basically what I call shattered in place. That is, all the interior had filled up with dirt over the years. So they were still retaining their original shape. But unfortunately, the wine had completely gone. Some of it had seeped into the pottery, the ceramic. So we were able to do organic residue analysis. And we can tell it was red wine. And it was seasoned, spiced with honey and juniper and mint. So we want to recreate it. I think it'd be fun. We want to pair with a winery today, see if we can recreate the Canaanite wine. Right now it's got like an earthy taste, but sorry, bad joke.
Yeah. Look, I didn't make any dig jokes till now. So, let's dig back into Megiddo then. So in digging at Megiddo, it was called the place where wars were going to, the where end all wars was going to take place, because so many wars took place there because of the crossroads. Is that right?
Exactly. So Megiddo was a crossroads of civilization for thousands of years. I mean, we've got 20 cities that are one on top of another inside the mound. The mound was originally about 70 feet tall. Now it's about 50 feet tall because the Jezreel Valley, which it overlooks, has been raised in the last couple of decades when they were filled in the swamps after the 1920s, 1930s. And then the archaeologists have taken off the top couple of layers. So it's lost about 20 feet, but it's still got 20 cities in there. First one was built in about 3000 BC, and the last one is about 300 BC. So just after Alexander the Great came through, it was abandoned. Not sure why. Probably the water source dried up. But it's a fascinating city. It was a center of commerce throughout time, and one Egyptian pharaoh, Thutmose III in 1479, said that the capturing of Megiddo was like the capturing of 1,000 cities. And it is true. In the ancient world, if you wanted to go from Egypt up to Turkey or over to Mesopotamia, what is now Iran and Iraq, you had to follow the Via Maris, the way of the sea, and that went right by Megiddo. So every invader that came into Israel fought a battle at Megiddo, except for Alexander the Great, because the area just gave in to him. But I wrote a book back in 2000 called The Battles of Armageddon, and counted up that we've had a tremendous number, something 32 battles, something like that, that have been fought in and around Megiddo, not counting the one that the Book of Revelation talks about, which is supposed to be the penultimate battle. So it's always been a major site, major military activity, and excavating there was just so much fun. Every other summer, you're walking across the mound, wondering, what's underneath my feet? If I stop walking right now and put a trowel in the ground, what will I find? So every day was just full of surprises. It was just absolutely wonderful to be excavating there. But, that's true for any ancient site. Cabri up in the north where we're digging now. And by the way, if anybody wants to come dig, we're going to be there June 18th to July 27th this summer. You can help us find more of the wine cellar. But, you know, every other site, Gezer and Hatzor and Lachish and Jerusalem, you know, this is the thrill of excavating that just brings us back every summer. It's just the thrill of discovery. And what more are we going to find about the ancient world?
There's a challenge for archaeologists to stop digging long enough to write up all the stuff they find.
Yes, this is always a problem. So, for instance, Kathleen Kenyon never properly published either Jericho or Jerusalem, and others, including Yadin, never properly published Hatzor. So, yeah, the urge to just keep digging is there. One of the things that we did at Megiddo is only to dig every other year. And that was so that we could study and publish the stuff in the interim. And so we've been pretty good. Israel Finkelstein and David Yushishkin and Baruch Halpert and myself have put out three volumes, in each case like a double volume, about every fourth or sixth year. So we're pretty up to date there publishing. But others, the problem is you just get absolutely overwhelmed with the number of potsherds that come out and the amount of data. And so really, if you don't stop and take what we call a study season every so often and publish what you got, you're totally overwhelmed. I mean, at Cabri right now, we're in the middle of putting together a volume that covers what we did from 2005 to 2011. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, here we are up in 2017, and we've got another couple of years that we could already publish on, but we need to keep it, in chronological.
All right, I have one selfish question. Not Jewish, but on a sabbatical trip, I went to Machu Picchu. Got to be the most spectacular sight I've ever seen in the world. What the heck was it?
Well, apart from the fact that I call it the mile and a half high city,
yes.
I mean, it is literally that high.
It's high.
It's still debated, actually, exactly what it is, but it's from one of the last Inca kings. It's connected to Cusco. It may be like a winter palace or a summer palace or even a weekend palace. But it's also got all kinds of other things. There seems to be an observatory there. There's also regular people living there. But it is one of the most fascinating and well-hidden cities. So I hope when you went there, you didn't suffer from altitude sickness, which a lot of people do.
No, I was good. Cusco's higher, and they give you that coca tea, and they don't tell you what it is. So you're usually just fine by then.
Excellent. Well, that is in the new book. I do Machu Picchu. I do the Moche. I do Peru. I do... Boy, if you like the New World, I've got that. If you like the Old World, I've got that. What I did in the new book was basically pick the stories that are of the greatest interest to me and that I think shed the greatest light on how archaeology has developed from the first time it was really used in Pompeii and Herculaneum to what we're doing now with computers and LIDAR and everything else. And this is what I teach my students every fall. It's what gets me, you know, up in the morning. And so I basically wanted to demonstrate and bring to everyone else just the love for archaeology and the fact that regardless where you live in the world, there's something that you can find and that you can read about.
I want to thank Professor Eric Klein for a wonderful visit here on Too Jewish. His book is called Three Stones Make a Wall, A Story of Archaeology. And where can people go to find out more about you, your digs, all of that?
Well, let's see. You can get the book on Amazon. You can look me up. Just Google Eric H. Klein, all with C's, and I will pop up. I've got my own website, but there's also a website at GW. And if you want to come digging with us, it's actually a WordPress site. It's Dig Cabri 2017, all one word, and there's all kinds of information there. We're actually full for the first half, but we could use some people in the second half in July. So if anybody's got digging on an ancient site on their bucket list, now's your time to cross it off.
In a beautiful part of Israel, by the way.
Absolutely, absolutely gorgeous. And we stay at the Western Galilee Field School, and so the Mediterranean is quite literally 100 feet from where we are housed. And I should add that our rooms have air conditioning.
Sounds like a place you could really dig. Thanks again. We come back here on Too Jewish. We'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi David Zaslow, author of the new book, Reimagining Exodus, A Story of Freedom. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or stream us from the TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish for the upcoming Festival of Freedom, Passover, beginning Monday, April 10th. Join us at Temple Emmanuel for a great second night Seder open to the community. Call 520-327-4501 or go to tetucson.org. Our playout from our Passover playlist of particularly pleasurable passages of Pesach song, here's the Sephardic icon Yehoram Gaon singing the classic Ladino song, Quien supiense y entiendense, who knows one? It's the concluding song to many a Passover Seder in one musical version or another. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good final week of Passover preparations, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Quien supiense y entiendense, alabar al Dios creyense, cualo es el uno, cualo es el uno. Uno es el Creador, uno es el Creador, uno es el Creador, Baruch Hu Baruch.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.